It's so easy to rigorously focus on the single problem that your product is trying to solve. It makes sense, so to speak, for your product team to only focus on the customer journey within the solution you're building, specific to the product. However, what if you knew that solution was solving for that problem only represented a small fraction of what you should focus on? What if you're not considering aspects outside your core product that could fundamentally impact if you're able to deliver business results or not? We're very fortunate to have an incredibly special guest with us today who will unpack what these things are that we should focus on outside the core product. Stay tuned. This is the Product Manager Podcast, the voices of a community that's writing the playbook for product management, development, and strategy. We're sponsored by Crema, a digital product agency that helps individuals and companies thrive through creativity, technology, and culture. Learn more at crema.us. Keep listening for practical, authentic insights to help you succeed in the world of product management. So today, we're very fortunate to have John Carter joining us. For those who don't know, John leads a storied career in new product development. He's advised many incredible organizations, including Apple, where he helped create the Apple new product process, which is used by Apple today, Amazon, HP, IBM, Fitbit, and Bose, where he was the chief engineer and inventor of the widely popular Bose noise-canceling headphones. Today, he is the founder and principal of TC Gen, a Silicon Valley management consulting firm focused on product development. John also serves on the board of directors at Cirrus Logic, a leading supplier of mixed-signal semiconductors. John is also the author of Innovate Products Faster, Graphical Tools for Accelerating Product Development. And John is also on the Forbes Business Council, where he recently published the Forbes article, Looking for Innovation in All the Wrong Places, Inventing Outside the Core. I'm so excited to join everyone listening in today to learn from John about inventing outside the core. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael.
So, innovation on the total product. Would it be okay if we talk about this for a bit?
Sure.
So, in your article, you start talking off about the need to innovate existing products. What did you learn from that?
Well, what I learned, and this is from working with clients as well as my corporate experience, is that there's so often a focus on something totally new, something that hasn't been imagined, or the resources are consumed on just feeding the feature train and managing the releases. And what I really noticed was that there's an opportunity for greater wallet share, and that is by looking more at adjacency. In other words, what's next to your product that you could capitalize on, and how do you maximize the value and margin of the products you're currently producing?
So your term, the total product, it's an all-encompassing definition for more than just the widget being made, so to speak. What are some of those things that includes?
Yeah, this is borrowed heavily from Theodore Levitt in The Marketing Imagination. And he really talked about, in very simple terms, the notion that there's the core product. That's when people think about product managers and engineers think about the core product to be delivered. It's a set of key features and the unique value proposition, et cetera. But people and companies don't buy that. They typically buy what's called the extended product. And the extended product is not only the core product, but it includes things like the brand, support, reliability, and comfort in knowing, let's say, that you've had some experience with that. So it's basically a brand promise that you buy when you buy the extended product. The augmented product is a much more all-encompassing term, because what it is both the core product, the extended product, and then additional services or features that you can add on top of the product set in order to extract more value. And so this total product is an opportunity for innovation, because often, Michael, the innovation in the core product is hard. It takes a lot of engineering cycles and a lot of support from IT and design and so forth, UX, UE. But if you look at innovating outside the core, you have an opportunity to maybe not be so R&D, research, and engineering developer intensive, but rather leveraging other parts of the organization, let's say IT or marketing or customer success.
Do most organizations, in your experience, think about the total product beyond just the core?
No, I don't think so. And it's real opportunity. Of course, there are some great examples. My favorites is FedEx, because FedEx, basically in the game to dominate overnight shipment, they're competing against United Parcel Service and U.S. Postal Service, those three. They were head and head in overnight delivery. What FedEx did, and why it's the undisputed leader there, is it simply looked at, well, what is the augmented product look like here? Now, they could have thrown more planes at it, more trucks, better logistical support to improve their performance versus UPS or UPS, United States Postal Service. They didn't do that. But what they did do is they invested in IT. What FedEx came out with was tracking. Tracking has nothing to do with logistics, airplanes, or trucks. In fact, you wouldn't say it's even a core competency of FedEx at the time. But what they did is they looked at their core product, which is delivering overnight packages, and then they solved the problem for customers, frankly, which wouldn't be needed if they were reliable. You don't need to track it if you get it on time. But the fact was that customers saw this as being so comforting, and knowing exactly where the package was at any point in time, FedEx innovated outside the core.
Yeah. And now today it's just expected that you have tracking if you want to compete with FedEx.
Everybody has it. It's been commoditized. Many firms send you a snapshot of the item in your front door. I mean, they really, really have closed the loop on this.
Yeah. So, you know, with a lot of organizations kind of not going fully invested into the total product, what do you think is getting in the way of more organizations going down that path?
I'm going to answer that, but I'm going to back up a little bit, because what you said was really important about this becoming expected. There's this model that this Japanese professor and leader taught called the Kano model. And basically what he says is the lighters of today will be the must-bes of tomorrow. And I think this kind of relates to this innovation concept, because really identifying those things that delight consumers is often a key role in how to be successful. But getting to your question, I think organizations in general think of the total product as the product, the core deliverable, maybe some service and support, and maybe customer success. In other words, they draw the boundaries too tightly around what they view is the product and don't look at the ways in which you could augment it. Obviously, you can think about things such as data, AI, ML, and many of the other enhancements from the IT space and data space that could be obvious candidates for creating an augmented product. Don't stop at customer success, though.
Yeah, yeah. They're not really thinking about what is like more beyond just the job to be done, but like just they're not really engaging in that full experience for the customer.
Exactly. And I think part of it, Michael, has to do with the mindset of many product people, that they tend to think about their comfort zone. They may have had a project management background or engineering background, and so they tend to be myopically focused on the core offering and the core value proposition, not really thinking about, well, here's an opportunity. What is the job to be done here? And there's a trap that many marketing folks get into, which is what I call checkbox marketing, or the notion of feature parity, or seeing a competitive entrant into the field and simply comparing their feature set with yours. They're solving the wrong problem. And what you need to do is you need to look at ways in which you can expand out of that narrow box of ticking off the checkboxes.
Yeah. So let's kind of shift gears a bit to finding ways to escape out of that narrow box and into directing innovation. Your background, your expertise, and your company, TCGen, is really focused on helping organizations figure out how to develop innovative products. What are your thoughts around if an organization should or shouldn't direct that innovation?
Well, in the Forbes piece, I kind of played around with this notion, and it's kind of a yes and no. I think on one hand, the biggest strategic thing that firms should do is, in fact, allocate budget for innovation. In other words, and rules of thumb that I use is 10% of product development or 1% of sales. Whichever you can afford or whichever one is more reasonable for you, make sure you have budget to support innovation. Ideally, although innovation is no individual's job function, everybody should be innovating. It does help to have an organization that's focused on innovation. There's a, you know, challenge there that sometimes they have resistance from the other parts of the organization because the ideas they throw over the wall aren't quite done and in the other organization's point of view. But frankly, any way that you can allocate and consistently invest on the budget of innovation is important. But more importantly than that, you know, there's a really good question, which is, you know, why Company X? Why now? In other words, what is it about you that in fact enables you to meet, compete, and beat your competitors and grow your market? And that is, let's say you've got the budget allocation of, let's say, 1% of sales to make it easy. The first thing you want to do in terms of directing innovation is think about strategic alignment. And Michael, this is a common mistake. Many firms simply respond to the last customer or the biggest customer. Mm-hmm. But in fact, that's a slippery slope because they may not be telling you needs about a whole expanded market. They may be a narrow segment. So the first and foremost thing, yes, customer input's very important. And obviously you can't go forward without that. And even though companies like Apple say that they don't take customer input, that's simply not true. They absolutely do, and all over the place. But if you look at fundamentally how you would direct innovation besides a budget allocation, I think that first and foremost is strategic alignment. In other words, you have a vision and you have a strategy. So you want to make sure that your innovation is congruent with the strategy. The second is you want to be able to leverage your core infrastructure. And this is, I often call, platform leverage. And this includes distribution channels. It could include your technology capabilities. But basically, it leverages the brand capability that your organization has. And the third criteria is that because innovation is risky, it should move the needle in terms of revenue and margin. So in a way, these are very loose guidelines, but I typically look at this triad of strategic alignment, platform leverage, and moving the needle as being three ways to direct innovation in the most fruitful way.
Very interesting. So you talk a little bit about budget allocation. How does an organization prioritize just resources in general across the board around differentiation, especially when you're talking about that triad?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, and of course it varies. You know, if you don't have strategic alignment, I think you're pretty much dead in the water. And if you don't have platform leverage, in other words, you can't advantage the brand's basically right to compete or privilege in the marketplace, you're wasting a huge opportunity. So assuming those two elements are in place, then how do you look at differentiation? How do you look at how much resource and effort should you put in this? How much budget around differentiation? Well, I think it's fundamentally 100% in many respects. In other words, the fact of the matter is that if you have a value proposition, some aspects of that value proposition are driven by unique selling points. And these are points of difference. So in addressing the why Company X, why now, is a fundamental notion that I believe that all resources should be prioritized around differentiation. Where you may want to make some trade-offs is how much do you put on the core product versus the augmented product? How much do you want to invest in totally new kinds of products? But to my way of thinking, Michael, all efforts in product should be around differentiation. Sometimes it's small, sometimes it's big, But if you don't have any differentiation, you're probably in a commodity market, probably, you know, going to be run more by accountants than creative product types. And so, therefore, I think that really organizing and focusing all resources around differentiation is critical. There's also this, it's a rule of thumb, and I think it's of limited value, but many people think about product portfolio management and, you know, how you prioritize investments. And fundamentally, if you kind of consider how much money should we place on bigger bets, there's a rule of thumb for mature companies, which is 70% core, 20% adjacent products, and 10% really breakthrough products. Startups have different ratios. Turns out that ratio is actually those numbers, the percentages are used by Google, but Google's a very mature company. In startups, it's probably, 30% core and 70% in the transformational category. But I think the overlay, Michael, is that all of the effort should be focused towards differentiation.
How does a company know if they're successful in those differentiation efforts? What are they measuring?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think in the tech world, you always look at things like churn rate and ARR growth, annual recurring revenue growth. But if you generalize that, I think one of the most important metrics is very simple to actually keep track of. And that is, how much net new sales have you gotten from this differentiable idea? In other words, you're running along, let's just say it's 10 million ARR, whatever the figure is. You're running along and you introduce a new product or feature. Sometimes that will cannibalize the 10 million, so your forecast may be not quite as rosy. But what you should look at is the differentiable. In other words, what were you earning before you did this differentiated product, and what were your revenues afterwards, and take the difference. And that difference is more or less attributable to the different products, the subsequent products with greater differentiation. Of course, if the market is growing or you're expanding, you have to take that into account. But the first parameter I'd look at is net new sales from differentiation. And then the reason why I'm so keen on innovating around the core is that you can get margin expansion. Many of the things in the augmented products, I mean, look at the FedEx example, which is I think salient in so many points. It didn't have to buy more trucks. It didn't have to buy more airplanes. Yes, it needed a lot of new IT equipment, and that's expensive. But IT equipment is typically 2% of revenue. So you go from 2% to 3%. You increase it 50%. Well, that's a pretty small price to pay for the fact that you can now charge, 30% more for tracking. So the second thing you look for is expansion in margin. How's your profit line improving with this differentiated feature? And in fact, if you're not getting margin expansion, I would say that you have insufficient differentiation. So it's a really good lens on the merits of your ideation. And then finally, I think the ultimate measure of this is share growth. In other words, are you taking a greater command of the market in a particular segment? So I think it's measurable and actually pretty rapidly.
That's really good. That's really good. So, we're talking about the total product, which, is also like the complete solution. And I'm really curious about further unpacking that a bit. In your Forbes article, you shared that customers don't want a piece of their problem solved. They want complete solutions. What's the difference between having a surface problem solved and being given a complete solution from the customer lens?
Yeah, I think this is a terrific, terrific question. And I think the most vivid example, in fact, Clayton Christensen talks about this among others. And that is that, customers saw a shop for a job to be done or a service to be delivered. So in the simple analogy used, on surface level problems, let's expand that to cleaning your house and floor surfaces. Basically, customers don't shop for mops. They want clean floors because clean floors is a job to be done. And you can see, you know, in this tiny little category, how much innovation there has been against mops with products like Swifter and other products that are very good at cleaning hardwood floors or non-carpets. And one of the reasons that's so brilliant is that they actually sell a consumable. So not only did they switch from making mops to making these floor cleaning solutions, but also you can't really sell buckets of water to consumers, but you certainly can sell cleaning sheets. And so if you think more broadly about the job to be done, this is where you can really think about and brainstorm and get some direction around the augmented product, because they think about the whole thing, the whole job to be done, not just replacing a narrow function by an existing product.
So how can organizations start to unpack that complete solution when they're focusing on the product strategy instead of only focusing on one dimension of the customer problem, i.e. not the job to be done? So Swiffer focusing on the mops, and then also, oh, hey, we can also create this other product where we're selling disposable throwaway sheets.
Yeah, I think this is it's a great question, and maybe this example is extendable to this. So you might look at your product strategy with different lenses. For example, there's a market position which is high performance, high cost. You might say Mercedes is that way in the car business, or Apple is in the computer business or phone business. And this particular strategy, this product strategy, is one in which emphasizes innovation, but also commands very high margin and high prices. But not all companies are innovators. Other companies are low-cost producers. They try and do an adequate job, but go for the lowest cost. So that's their product strategy. And the third category you might look at is agile or fast learners or iterators. And I'd actually put Amazon in this category, which is Amazon is a relentless iterator. It did not invent e-commerce. It didn't invent cloud computing. But the fact it's now the everything store, and Amazon Web Services is the leading market share in terms of remote computing services. And in fact, it's really interesting to know that AWS, even though it's much smaller than the rest of Amazon, generates 70% of its profit. Mm-hmm. So they weren't even in the store business for cloud computing, only they leveraged their own capability to make that available outside that, and it's turned into the biggest profit driver for Amazon of all their businesses. So I think you need to first figure out, well, what is your product strategy? And then, as we talked about at the beginning with the notion of making sure that you've got strategic alignment, is then really looking at how we use the strategic framework, whether you're innovative, high margin, low cost producer, iterator. And then I'd recommend this use of techniques like design thinking or customer led innovation as a way to give you some insight into the jobs to be done. Because even if you're a low cost producer, there are great ways in which you can augment what you do and what you offer to consumers. It's important to be congruent with the overall product strategy you're pursuing.
One of the examples you just gave really stuck out to me with AWS and just the huge amounts of revenue that is producing for Amazon. I've certainly read a lot of studies just on that. And that can be very alluring for a lot of organizations to try to create their own, AWS, so to speak. But for an organization who might just be coming to the mindset of focusing on the complete solution, is this going to be more costly for me? Is this maybe an impediment? This cost may be an impediment to more organizations having this mindset that leads to incredible results like AWS and the other examples?
That's a big, it depends, Michael. First thing, I think we need to differentiate between CapEx and OpEx. In other words, some investments to create the total product might be more in the capital expenditure area. I'm thinking about IT in particular. And then other things are OpEx. In other words, they reduce margin or increase the cost of goods sold. You know, I'm looking at a SaaS model or talking about customer acquisition costs, for example. But the notion is that these should all pencil out because maybe there's a higher capital equipment cost. Maybe there's a higher operational expense that goes along with this innovation. But the fact is that they lead to higher revenues, higher than probably your standard product margin is, and more likely market share, which you might either capture or, in fact, grow the market. And therefore, ultimately, it should be justified. In other words, no argument it's more expensive, but if you look at an incremental basis, it should be, if you will, very well justified because you can charge more margin and demand more wallet share because you complete the job to be done. So, yes, there is a penalty, but the payback is there.
So how does a product organization align to focus on the complete solutions instead of just focusing on solving a few problems for their customers?
Well, I'm sure at Crema you have some really great techniques for doing this, but I think if you combine the systematic, deliberate investment in innovation, say 1% of share revenue that I mentioned, the ways in which you can best realize the greatest value is customer visits in the environment of use, sometimes called customer inquiry. But it's the notion, and it was highlighted by the early pioneers in design thinking, even before the Stanford D School, was really this whole notion of customer empathy. And so you combine dedicated funding for innovation and you get real customer insight, I think you can really, really make sure that you solve the problem. And I'll give you a great example from my Bose days. So when we were working on the headphones, and I worked with Dr. Bose to come up with this early concept of active noise reduction, we didn't call it that. We called it a servo system around headphones. And we thought the primary benefit of the headphones would be that they'd sound better. In other words, they'd have more bass, they'd have less variation from user to user, they'd be more consistent and have a much more realistic reproduction. But what we found after visiting with customers is that no, that's, people don't care about that. They care about noise reduction. And this insight, had we had it earlier, might have been able to shave some time off development because we spend a lot of time on optimizing sound quality and we should have spent time optimizing noise reduction. So these customer visits in the environment of use are really important. And the reason I say environment of use is that unless you're seeing what the customer sees, it's hard for you to really innovate the total solution.
Yeah, definitely preach that. So how are other organizations moving towards the model of focusing on the complete solution?
Yeah, I think that the obvious one, and, you know, as tech startups, but tech organizations in general, increasingly focus on data and artificial intelligence or machine learning to take the lead there. I think it's a natural first step, and I've even seen very, very large $30 billion insurance companies also get into this game because they have so much data. But the fact is, you can really use your data as a way to augment services and keep ahead of the competition. You know, Amazon, again, has some great examples when it will actually indicate to you, based on your history, it thinks you're running low on detergent, and so would you like some to arrive next Tuesday? This is a very simple example, but it gets back, Michael, to the job to be done. Job to be done is having clean clothes, and if you have to make one less shopping trip or lug a big box of detergent home, Amazon can deliver it to your door and at the time predicted by your prior use. And that's a great example of data and AI. The other area I mentioned is obviously customer inquiry. So it's a way to focus maybe where these innovations may take place in terms of augmented features or other services that would help consumers in their job to be done. And I think what is really cool about Microsoft, which is definitely having a resurgence now, is that they're focused almost exclusively on innovation. They, as you know, they shed their disastrous Nokia investment, just trying to get in the mobile phone market, and that was a mistake. And so now the leadership is really focused on everything that they do, setting the bar high. In other words, setting the bar, is it innovative? Are we going to make a difference here? Google's the same way. They try and solve really hard, big problems. And so setting the bar with your organization to really encourage your leaders to take risks, but really strive to move the needle, I think is another way in which to motivate and channel your organization towards a complete solution.
So speaking of moving the needle, let's talk a little bit about actually innovating, the actual act of innovating outside the core. What are some ways that organizations can move towards innovating outside the core?
Yeah, well, I've mentioned design thinking, and I think that's an obvious. And it and, you know, Jake Knapp at Google Ventures came up with something called design sprints, which is a much, you may use it at Crema. It's a much shorter 5-day exercise to really pack in innovation. But this crucible of getting a cross-functional team together with the customer, not selling, not designing a product, but really trying to understand the challenges in the environment of use and get the customer empathy, I think, is really key. The other thing, Michael, we started with, which is also super important, is this notion of deliberate investment in differentiation and innovation. And this requires investment year after year after year. Very rarely can you achieve, you know, a unique selling proposition or a new-to-the-world value proposition unless you have some real effort in some area. Innovation is not easy. And part of this, I think, you can mentally carve out some freedom to operate by managing the budget that you spend feeding your basic platform, your basic release cycle, and yeah, you could give it 120% of all the product development budget, but it's much better to, you know, limit it to 80%, do the best job you can with 80%, and then allocate the rest of that towards innovation and new kinds of thinking. So this not getting swallowed by the platform release cycle and just this treadmill of product and feature upgrades over the roadmap. It takes discipline to do, but nevertheless, it's an opportunity to really avoid being suckered into Me Too thinking.
So I think I have an idea, but what is your favorite way that organizations can innovate outside the core?
Well, I would say it's focus. And that is focus on these areas that are more fragile where you may not have a real customer set, but really focus on the innovation. And I don't mean focus in a platitude way. What I mean is not doing some things. I don't believe innovation is a peanut butter process. I don't believe that you should try and innovate everything you do. I think, frankly, that's a waste of time. What you need to do is marshal and focus your innovations in a couple select areas so you achieve true differentiation and true traction. Too many companies take the approach that they try and democratize innovation, and that's a fundamental mistake. I mean, it sounds nice, but the fact of the, and everybody cares about differentiation, but I want to separate improvement from innovation. Everybody should be constantly improving what they do and how they do it. But I think in general, a smaller set of people should really be focused on really this fundamental differentiation in terms of what we would call innovation, not improvement.
That's awesome. So how would you recommend that someone listening to this podcast get started in shifting their team or organization's focus towards innovating outside the core?
Well, there are many places to look for insights here, but one I'd recommend is our website at tcgen.com. We have some great in-depth guides on product development strategy and the augmented product that might get you going here.
Awesome. Yeah, I took a look at those and they are incredibly valuable resources. So definitely recommend checking that out. You know, before we wrap up, John, would it be okay if I ask some personal lightning round questions?
Sure. Go right ahead.
So these are things that, you know, as we talk to leaders in products such as yourself, it's kind of nice for our listeners to know, you know, what are some of these things that make you you? So for you, what of your personal habits have contributed the most to your success?
Well, it's selective neglect. And this sounds like a funny term, but it's something I actually learned as an undergraduate. My roommates, our suite mates across the hall, had very high grade point average. And I just wondered, because I was being buried under homework. And then I asked one of them, and he simply said, selective neglect. And that has served me so well, both in terms of living my life as well as on the work front, because you can't do everything. And it's a terrible disservice to try and do a half job on everything or try and do everything as a CEO. You just can't. And so you have to choose what you work on and try and bend the arc of the universe. And you can do that through selective neglect.
What's your favorite tool that you use regularly?
Yeah, I don't know really how to answer this, but I can say that I'm collaborating a lot more. And so a tool such as Google Docs, which is now an incredibly effective and powerful, full-featured and responsive cloud-based app, I don't think I could live without. I know it's not a breathtaking insight, but nevertheless, it is the tool of choice for collaboration, and I think we're going to see it expand and expand.
And lastly, for someone at the start of their product management journey today, what's the one piece of advice that you would give to them?
Well, this is something I stole from Dr. Bose, and that is that better implies different, not the other way around. In other words, just because you're different, you add a new feature or new wrapper or whatever, it doesn't mean you're better. But on the other hand, to be better implies you're different from the rest of the pack. So make sure when you think about differentiation, you think about better, not just different.
That is so valuable today, especially in a space where it can be easy to fall into the trap of generalization, not specialization.
Right.
So, John, thank you so much. I don't know about you, but the last 35 minutes or so have gone incredibly fast for me, learning so much from you. So thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
Awesome. So you can find more about John at his site, tcgen.com. There's also loads of the incredibly helpful content available for free that he mentioned, ranging from product development to agile and project management. Again, thank you so much, John, for coming on the show today. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Definitely leave a review on this podcast with any questions or feedback. And follow and join our community as well at theproductmanager.com. Thank you all. Thank you, John.
Thank you.